So my presentation is called Moving OKR. And as Auntie Betty pointed out, there's a lot of calumny in that, which I won't go into because it doesn't necessarily represent the views of the Department of Health. So I just kind of leave that. Self-determination is a determinant of health. Okay, so our learning objectives have a better, I'm not going to go over the learning objectives unless you want me to. We have three. I have no relationships. Well, relationships with my ohana, with my aina, but I have no financial relationships to disclose, except I owe a lot of money because of medical school. Okay, so what are inequities? Well, I like to use this word instead of disparities, because inequities implies two things. One implies that the differences between different groups or between individuals is not natural. And the second thing is that it's not right. It's not normal, it's not ethical, it's not necessarily even moral for these differences to be there. And so the three tests I've been talking about would be health status, that is how well or how sick people are, the access to care, quality to care are three types of inequities that we can discuss. Okay, so what about for indigenous peoples? Well, unfortunately, throughout the world, almost all indigenous peoples face higher morbidity and mortality burdens than majority groups. And to my knowledge, there isn't one indigenous group that doesn't face these kind of inequities. But importantly, the differences aren't fully explained by the traditional biomedical model of disease. What is a traditional biomedical model of disease? Well, you probably didn't want to ask that question, but a traditional biomedical model of disease is that whether we are sick or whether we are well is a combination of the personal choices that we make, that is, the foods we eat, whether or not we get exercise, the exposures that our bodies have to different toxins and pathogens, as well as our genetic vulnerabilities or strengths. For example, in Aotearoa, 43% of the inequity between Maori and Pākehā is explained from 10% from higher smoking among the Maori, and 33% from identifiable socioeconomic factors. And what are those? Those would be like poverty, differences in education, differences in housing, these such. But for 57% of the differences, and unfortunately, as in other places, Maori live 7 to 10 years less than the Europeans in Aotearoa or New Zealand, probably results from racism or colonialism, which contributes to socioeconomic deprivation and together produces health disparities. So let's look at Hawaii, and you know, because I'm also a chronic disease epidemiologist, I had to throw in data, so calmly, I try not to put in too much figures, but here's a little bit. Okay, so let's look over here at the Native Hawaiian. Now, this is the bottom. Now, you should, for those people who don't know, the cost of living in Hawaii is higher than almost anywhere else in the US. Probably New York and Alaska probably were sort of tied, but $10,000 is starvation, basically. So you can see that, oh, my arrow left, okay. 4.5% of Hawaiians are here, 10.9% of other Pacific Islanders, but here at the other end, here we have 23% of Chinese making $75,000 or more, 10% of Filipinos, 25% of Japanese, only 14% of Hawaiians, 10% of Pacific Islanders, and 26.2% of whites. Now, there are some skews in this data because remember, a lot of the Caucasian population of Hawaii is military. So they're going to have slightly lower salaries than the people who are living there. So there are some differences, but we want to see that the skew of the Hawaiian and Pacific Islander population is really to this side. And poverty, well, let's take a look. 0 to 130%, and what are these figures? Well, these are whether or not you qualify for Medicaid or other social services, depending on the percentage of the federal poverty guidelines. So we can see that 71% of Chinese are above, 48% of Filipinos are above, 79%, almost 80% of Japanese are above. Only 50% of Hawaiians are above the poverty line, 30% of Pacific Islanders, and 75% of whites. Type 2 diabetes. Well, unfortunately, we can see that Hawaiians have the highest rate Now, what about these bars? These are called confidence intervals. Does anyone know what confidence intervals are? Okay, so a few people know. But for those people not who don't know, oh, sorry.
I don't know if I can go backwards. No, that didn't do it.
So confidence interval means that we can't, when these are confidence intervals are very broad, we can't be very sure about where the real number lies in this. It could be here, it could be here, but we can't be very, very exact. But we know that unfortunately other Pacific Islanders tend to have some of the worst health outcomes in Hawaii. Obesity. Why are there two figures? Well, a lot of people don't know. We have two sets of definitions of obesity. One are the standard definitions, which were based upon European Americans in the middle of America in the 1950s. And there's a whole other set of definitions, one for Polynesians and one for Asians, which haven't been adopted by the World Health Organization, but which have a better distribution of, which show us more what overweight or obesity are according to our ethnic groups. So for Polynesians, including Native Hawaiians, it's moved up. That is, obesity and overweight are moved up from 25 to 27 and from 30 to 32. For Asians, it's moved down from 25 to the other direction, even maybe as low as 20, because there's some evidence showing that for Asians, I know we're talking about Pacific Islanders, Native Hawaiians, but it's good to know this kind of stuff. Some evidence for Asians that Asians are much more vulnerable at lower BMI for cardiometabolic disease and things like that. And please feel free to raise your hand because, you know, I use a lot of terms which might not necessarily be accessible to everyone. So if you don't understand, interrupt me. So what is this showing? Well, our typical picture is that Hawaiians and other Pacific Islanders are in fact the most obese. But when we use the ethnic-specific definitions, look at this. Asians move over. And in fact, we see a very much higher percentage of Asians. And actually, Hawaiians move in a healthier direction. Unfortunately, other Pacific Islanders remain the most obese. Asthma. Well, we've known this for a long time now. Hawaiians have the highest asthma rates. Incarceration. This is, to me, one of the key indicators for health, the health of a nation, the health of a people. And what can we see here? Well, this is according to the Department of Public Safety. They say 39% of all the people incarcerated in the Hawaii prison system are Native Hawaiian. Now, we're about 20% of the population. Is this really true? I would argue, in fact, no, this is not true. This figure is more like 60 to 70%. And that is based on anecdotal data, but if we were able to do real good data collection in the Department of Public Safety system, we would see 60 to 70% of all people incarcerated are Native Hawaiian. And you can, I mean, just that figure by itself means we are not doing well. We're not doing well. And I would say it's more for structural reasons, more of the system, than anything having to do with us, our genes or anything.
Okay, so why are some of these so you're saying they're misclassified as
right? They do it. It's sort of an arbitrary system. Uh-huh. Sometimes they do it upon last name, uh-huh. And a lot of Hawaiians, for example, Auntie Betty is Jenkins. My name is Liu. Jenkins is a Caucasian name. Liu is a Chinese. Well, actually, be Samoan or Tongan, but mine is Chinese. So based upon just our last names, they say, oh, you know, here this person is Caucasian, this person is Chinese, you know, there's a whole Smith family, which is more than 50% Hawaiian. So a lot of the classification is arbitrary and not really done on a scientific basis.
Can I speak to that? Again, it's anecdotal and not scientific, but I worked at OAVA, OCCC, and they have a women's as well as I just know that it's more than 40%. I never counted it, but it's the majority. That's why I would say 60 to 70% would be correct, because that's one of the most shocking things. Well, it's not shocking when you know that populations are imprisoned that way, but it's mostly Hawaiian people in the jail.
And in fact, in the youth correctional facility, it is 60 to 70%. That is reported by the Department of Public Safety. So that's even worse. I mean, these are people that are being incarcerated at an early age, and we know that that's a prime, when we want to talk about risk factors, that's a risk factor for recidivism and reincarceration.
So what are some of the factors having to deal with this? Well, one of these is multi-generational trauma. And a lot of people may have heard of this, also called historical trauma, intergenerational trauma. And this has to do with the loss of self-esteem, which leads to fatalism and a deterministic worldview. Basically, this concept had to do with evolved from people who were Holocaust survivors. And what researchers noted was that the children of Holocaust survivors had worse health outcomes than people who were not, who were basically the same people. And they started to ask, why was this? Well, the theory is that people re-experienced the traumas that their kupuna, or that their elders, or their parents, or elders, or many generations removed, have experienced. So the past is really not the past. The past is still the present. Okay? So that when we, that as far as historical trauma, that what we have to do is to reconstruct identity in the connections with the own and the dominant culture. And it has a lot to do with anxiety buffer. And that's, of course, a psychological thing, that one's ability to deal with stress is the anxiety buffer. And historical trauma breaks down that buffer, just as chronic stress breaks down that buffer. So meaning and standards of behavior leads to renewal of self-esteem. So what basically Antibedu was speaking about in the last session. For missing variables, what decides this? Well, we have to realize that cultural values and practices are always in a particular historical, political, and cultural context. The culture constructs meaning in the world. That is, that we don't have meaning outside of a culture. Now, whether that's our own indigenous culture, whatever your culture, your indigenous culture is, or someone else, language and culture construct the meaning in the world. We don't understand the world without the culture. And that self-esteem can only result from action in a meaningful world. If the world doesn't have meaning for you, then, in fact, it's very difficult to have self-esteem. What about mediators of chronic stress? Well, chronic stress has been associated with higher morbidity and mortality, but it's controversial. What is the pathophysiology? What are the pathways? Well, I have a whole series of presentations on why that is, and if you'd like to ask some questions about how chronic stress on the outside translates on the inside, I'll be happy to, since it seems like we may have a lot of time, I'll be happy to talk about that as well. Does stress mediate accessing the healthcare system and adherence? What does that mean? Well, does being stressed out, and we're not talking about just the normal stress of, you know, I gotta give my presentation, or I gotta make the next meeting. We're talking about the stress of poverty. We're talking about the stress of racism. We're talking about the fact that in our own land, we are disenfranchised. So do those stresses mean that it's more difficult to access the healthcare system? Does it mean that it's less likely that we're gonna take medications or follow other medical advice? Possibly. Because, you know, the standard, rather racist thing that I hear from a lot of people is like, oh, Hawaiians never like listen. Hawaiians don't like to listen to their doctors. You know, they don't take their medicine, they don't exercise, they don't eat the right foods. And then if you hear the worst things, like, oh, they're just fat and lazy. And I'm sure that a lot of people here have heard this in their own context, that, you know, this is not new. But this is what we hear, you know, non-compliant, yeah? Problematic social behaviors are...
What's my time like?
5 minutes.
I have 5 minutes left.
Yes.
Okay.
So I'm going to fly through this. Just to basically say that a lot of the social behaviors that we associate with bad health are not indigenous to our cultures, that they're learned. And most generational trauma, we talked about this. Racism, of course, that's the obvious one. And what is self-determination, and could it account for some of the disparities or inequities? First of all, it's a fundamental right of all peoples, not just indigenous peoples, but all peoples. And I would say it's a fundamental right of all of existence. If we talk about it in the sense of interconnectedness, I believe that the pohaku, the rocks, the wai, the water, the air, the birds, all the animals, they have just as much a right to self-determination as we do, as humans do. But of course, humans don't really have as much of right of self-determination that we can exercise as we like, so it's hard to argue sometimes with plants. It includes the right to the realization of the highest attainable standard of physical and mental health, and a right to traditional medicines and to maintain traditional health practices.
Of course, the U.S. was one of the countries that opposed the Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and we still haven't signed this. What about Native Hawaiian self-determination? Well, the Kanaka Maoli, or Native Hawaiians, have been in Hawaii since time immemorial. Kamehameha established the kingdom in 1810, and importantly, the international community recognized the kingdom as an independent state as far back as 1843. And we, in fact, had electricity and a telephone in Iolani Palace before the White House. So to say that we were a backward country, not very accurate.
And 97% literacy?
Yes.
Prior to the overthrow.
Yeah. Yeah, before the overthrow. What happened? Well, obviously, colonization itself cannot be separated from ill health. History is not only in the past. We have continued to have stigmatization, marginalization, loss of cultural identity, and a health status that falls below that of the plurality. And this, of course, is our flag. And this, of course, is the U.S. Marines landing on July 16, 1893, to begin the invasion of Hawaii. This is a petition against annexation. This is Liliuokalani, our last queen, walking up the steps of the palace for her trial for treason. This was annexation when the illegal government purportedly transferred, and this is not the views of the Department of Health, of course, when the illegal government transferred control of Hawaii to the United States. This was statehood in 1959, where anyone could vote who had been there for 1 year. And this is President Clinton signing the Apology Resolution in 1993. Impact is lack of self-determination. We have significant health and other disparities with many other groups, despite numerous U.S. and state initiatives. How could a loss of self-determination lead to health disparities? Well, we know as far back as W.B. Du Bois in 1906 that the aggregate effects of the social determinants of health are far greater than individual choice in genetics. And that medicine is supposed to be a social science, and they're supposed to be advocates, although that doesn't happen too much more. Importantly, I think I have 2 minutes left.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I have 2 minutes left, because I can see I'm waiting over here for my next presentation. The current political economy is a paradigm of high stress, low control at a group level, and people who know basic psychology know that high stress, low control is the worst situation you could be in. And you don't have to be a person to know that. I mean, that's what they find out from rats, right? I mean, rats who perceive that they don't have a lot of control over their situation and they're under a lot of stress are going to live shorter time. But there's multiple dimensions to self-determination. External, of course, is self-rule. Now, we're in a very large debate about the Kaka bill and other legislation, but there's many different opinions upon what external self-rule would mean. But what about internal? Well, economic and natural resources, cultural, social, and human security. What is health? Well, we talked about a little bit about this, and this is my political commentary that under this model, a healthy person is a good American. The Hawaiian model is intimately linked to relations between Hawaii and the West. That is, health is closest to the pre-continent state, access to and resources to practice traditional culture, and recovery and reproduction of identity, self-esteem, and efficacy. So in conclusion, indigenous health is multifactorial, yet measuring self-determination, trauma, and colonialism may provide more epidemiological power in explaining health disparities because usually we don't measure these. In fact, it's traditionally been more difficult to measure these, but I can argue and explain why I don't think that's true. Improving health equity in Hawaii and other locations if we do this, and conduct indigenous-specific health assessment will actualize self-determination. And finally, self-determination may begin with recognition and reconciliation. And I have a whole bunch of references. So, looks like I'm... Oh, wait, I'm sorry. Okay, we have our next presenter. So, I will take questions, and then we have an expert presenter, and then I'll go after that. Any questions?
Kavika, you said culture is the lens by which the world and interact with the world, and so as far as like indigenous Hawaiian culture goes, I mean, how would you characterize the relationship between sort of kind of pre-contact indigenous culture and culture among Native Hawaiian people now?
Well,
or among Kanaka Maoli?
Sure. There's a lot of Keawe, Kohonokula, and Kamna Opono have been doing some research looking at modes of acculturation, and that is how people relate to their culture. There's basically three modes. There's the traditional mode, the bicultural mode, or sorry, four modes, the assimilationist mode, and then I forgot the name of the fourth, but it's basically distance from both cultures. And what we found is, or what they found, and it's really ironic, is that people who are in the most traditional mode actually have the worst health outcomes. Now why is that? That's not what you would find probably on the continent or in Alaska. It's because people aren't able to exercise traditional culture. And so we know that there's actually more people relating in a traditional mode now with the growth of the language and charter schools and other things. But the problem is for people who want to practice the culture is access to the land, access to water, access to oceans, being able to express, for example, traditional spirituality is difficult. So I would say that it's a very complex relation. I mean, you know, for example, hula was not invented for entertainment or for competition. It was invented to mediate with akua, to mediate with the gods and one's family gods and the elements. And a lot of times that's been removed from the practice. So now you have halau from all over the world. Not to say they shouldn't be doing it, but they don't have that element. And you know, a lot of people, it's reduced to, oh, it's just competition or I'm going to make money with it. Language isn't quite like that, but you know, certainly I would say the prostitution of the culture has made it difficult because a lot of people, even within our own community, have very strange ideas about what it is the culture is. I mean, it's not a live thing. It can be a commodity sometimes. Any other?
How could you break the cycle?
How can we break the cycle? Well, what we're looking to try and do is to research population level behavioral health interventions. And there's not a lot of, I don't know if people can enlighten me, but to my understanding, there's not a lot of research in that area because we don't have enough psychologists and psychiatrists, obviously, to treat this, I mean, to treat, you know, 400,000 to a million cases of cultural trauma. Nor do we know, you know, the best. But I think that one of the things we can do is learning our language, are re-relating to our culture, achieving some degree of self-determination again, being able to exercise that inherent right to self-determination. So there's some things we're doing as internally, and there's some things we need help to do externally. Any other questions? And it's also breaking the structural violence and systemic racism. I mean, we know that despite the achievements of you know, Native Hawaiians, it's been uneven. I mean, you know, certainly you have a few Hawaiians at the top, but for the vast majority of Hawaiians are, you know, still not at the top or not evenly distributed. So that's part of it as well.
Would you recommend that like me not go there as tourists?
No, I think you can do it. You can do it in a way which is learned, which is respectful. I mean, we don't have yet, unfortunately, yet as many indigenous owned, and we don't have. If you want to see models are in New Zealand or Aotearoa, where there's really the Maori have been able to do a great job of reappropriating the culture, so that, for example, you can't just say. You can't use a, say, mahalo rubbish truck. I mean, mahalo means thank you. Well, not really, but it's been made to say thank you, right? So they say, like, mahalo, it says mahalo on the rubbish cans, on the garbage cans. And so people think that mahalo means rubbish. And of course it doesn't. But you know, there isn't a way, we don't have a way of saying for right now that you can only use a language if you use it in a respectful way, and you can only use a language actually if you're paying a royalty fees. I mean, you know, the military occupies more than 25% of Oahu, some of the most expensive real estate in the country, yet pays nothing. So I would say you can do it in a respectful way. Try and learn as much as you can. There are tours which are given by indigenous peoples. There's many things which people don't usually do. They usually just stay in Waikiki or they go snorkeling or something like that. But if you try and learn the culture, no, I think that we need it because a lot of local people, that's the way they learn they earn their living. And until we can break that cycle, we got to depend on that. Any other questions?
Thank you, Dr. Liu.
Our next speaker is Dr. Lawrence Miyake. Dr. Lawrence Miyake is currently a member of the Commission on Water Resource Management for the State of Hawaii, which manages and regulates the state's ground and surface freshwater resources. He is the author of the 2004 book, Water and the Law in Hawaii, published by the University of Hawaii, and was the founding executive director of Papalolo Coffee. A former director of health for the State of Hawaii and conducted health policy studies for the U.S. Congress. He retired in 1998 and spends his weekdays swimming at Ala Moana Beach Park with his wife and friends. Please welcome Dr. Lawrence Miyake.
I believe the first speaker is also one following me. Yeah, so we have an hour and a half, so I guess I'll take half an hour. I think there is half an hour scheduled at the end.
Yeah. Yes.
Mm-hmm. How many of you are from Hawaii or Hawaiians or know Hawaii? How many of you don't? Because part of the, actually his talk actually segues very nicely into mine. The theme of this conference is water and public health. And as many of you from Hawaii know, water was critically important to Hawaiians. And the word Hawaii, doubled up means well, Hawaii. And of course, the Hawaiians are only the second child in Hawaiian mythology. The first child was the Tarot Man. So he's the younger brother of the Tarot Man. Rather than showing you power presentations, I'm going to give you an excuse to fall asleep. You can close your eyes, but I'm going to draw you some word pictures to begin with. And what I'm going to be talking about is how important water, especially surface water, because it was only in modern times that we began to drill. Hawaiians knew about groundwater to seeps and springs, and they were Kani and Kanaloa, or Lohan gods, who loved to drink kawa. And anytime they wanted to drink kawa, they would whack the ground, and a spring would come up, and they would drink. So there are dozens of places around Hawaii with the name Kani's, the springs of Kani or Kanaloa, etc. Or we're going to talk about surface water, because that was really where most of the Hawaiians' water came from. And that was what happened and transformed Hawaiian cultural practices when Westerners came to Hawaii and the big sugar plantations came in, and all of the water was shifted to a sugar production, with Hawaiian laws supporting all of that. But I want to start off by sort of giving you some word pictures about how important streams were to Hawaiian diets and culture and traditional gathering practices. You all know that the Hawaiian land system was based on Ahuoa, and most of them had a stream central to it. And since time immemorial, I saw that little phrase up on one of his slides, Hawaiians had awai ditches that transformed water from streams into lands along the Ahuoa with taro patches everywhere. Also, within those streams were aquatic life that was actually pretty important to Hawaiian diets. And if you go to islands like Molokai, they still practice that pretty well. In these streams are fish, crustaceans, and mollusks. There are about five fish holo, four of which have ventral fins and a few so they can climb. And actually, if you go to the island of Hawaii and go above Akaka Falls, you can find not only fish, you can find shrimp up there. And all of these have a life cycle in the ocean, sort of like, but not quite like sand. When the time comes to spawn, the fishes in the fish in the upper reaches, there'll be a freshet in the mountains and the stream will flow quickly. They'll let themselves be transported down into the lower stream reaches where they will spawn. When the fry hatch, they get swept out to sea. And sometime later, nobody knows what happens out there, but they come back as fingerlings up the streams and eventually all the way up and repopulate and reproduce again. So if you have a totally degraded stream in Hawaii and you rejuvenate it, you don't have to do anything. Because these fish and crustaceans and mollusks are not stream specific. They will go back to any stream that there is fresh water flowing down and they will repopulate that. So you restore the stream, you don't have to restore the fish land. They will go out there themselves. Okay? Well, let me draw you a few more pictures and then move on to how that radically changed under Western concepts of property and law. You all know that one of the early missionaries was Hiram Bingham. In 1820, when the first came to Honolulu, he climbed up Punchbowl Hill. It was called Punchbowl then. And this is what he saw. He said, "Below us on the south and west spread the plain of Honolulu, having its fish ponds and salt-making pools along the seashore, the village and port between us and the harbor, and the valley stretching a few miles north into the interior, which presented its scattered habitations and numerous beds of kalo otaro in its various stages of growth, with large green leaves beautifully embossed in the silvery water in which it flourishes. Through this valley, several streams descending from the mountains in the interior wind their way some 6 or 7 miles, watering and overflowing by means of numerous artificial canals, the bottoms of kalo patches, and then by one mouth fall into the peaceful harbor." That was a typical scene of what you saw along any stream in Hawaii before Westerners claimed to discover Hawaii. Okay. Now, if you also look at a book that many of you know, which is Mary Bukui's Olelo Noia, I've picked a few of the poetical sayings out of that. And excuse my Hawaiian, I'm trying to interpret it. Ka'ia mili I ka po'o o ka lima, translated then means the fish fondled by the palm of the hand. So what it was when it was a season for the hinana, which is the open spawn coming back into the streams, they were so numerous that they could be scooped up in the palm of the hand. And Hawaiians are known in the old days to make reed nets, and they would scoop them up and they would get hundreds and thousands of those in which they could be little fingerlings. Another one is Ka'ia o o Pumehana I ka reawea, the fish that wants the clump of grass. And what that means is mountain shrimp or mai, which cling to weeds and grasses along the banks of stream when a cloudburst occurs in the uplands. So when there's a rush, they all grab and hang on. And I know Hawaiians who then go up there with nets and shake to the grass and they take a big walk. And they fry them with a little bit of salt, and it's like eating popcorn, you know? You've got hundreds of things to eat. Then the last one I read is Ka'ia mauna o ole o ke kahawai, the fish of the stream that requires no bait. And that means the hihiwai, or shellfish, where you turn over rocks and you find them underneath and you grab them. You don't need any bait. And Hawaiians I know today also eat those in a big wok, but with butter and garlic. Just like how we sort of eat, what do you call those little snails? So that was from those very common sayings, you know that fish, crustaceans, and fish and mollusks were an important part of the diet. And if you read scattered things like Isabella Bird's visit to 6 months in the Hawaiian Islands, you'll find that on Hawaii, when she stopped at a hut, somebody gave her an open to eat. And in other places, in terms of poi, you'll talk about how prodigious the amount of poi that people would eat, or if they were smashed or pounded and then dried, that's what you took on journeys as your food. So it was very important then. But then, let me read you from James Michener's Hawaii, published in 1959. you don't mention, if any of you don't mention her, he always starts off with billions and billions of years ago, you know, he talks about how the land is forming. But this is 1959, and this, I think, perfectly reflects the Western attitude about water resources up to about 1973. This is mentioned. Tremendous quantities of rain fell on the islands, but it fell in an unproductive manner. From the northeast, trade winds blew constantly, pushing ahead of them low clouds, excuse me, pregnant with sweet water. But along the northeast shores of each island, high cliffs rose and mountains, and these reached up and knocked the water out of the clouds so that it fell in cascades which could not be used and never reached the southwest plains where the red soil was. Of the flat land that could be tilled, fully three-fourths were in fact deserts. And this is this. If one could capture the wasted water that ran useless down in the steep mountain sides and back out to sea, bringing it through the mountains and onto the flatlands, then crops would be grown. But until this was accomplished, men who lived on these islands would never have enough water or enough food. Contrast that to what I just read to you about pre-contact Hawaii. So, here we are in Hawaii, our big and looks out in 1820. Sees all this color growing. In 1867, I think this was the very first Hawaii Supreme Court case involving water rights. It said, under English common law, people who live along streams had a right to use water from streams. They didn't own it. They could use the water along with other people living along the streams as long as they didn't take it off and they shared. That was English common law. So, the Hawaii Supreme Court in 1867 said, so if a riparian proprietor should interfere with an ancient Hawaii by which other lands had been watered from time immemorial, he would be liable in damages. A right to interfere with the natural right to make use of water belonging to another when it is connected with the occupation of land constitutes an easement in favor of the latter as the dominant estate. What they're saying was that they used the Hawaiian tradition of Hawaii taking water away from the streams to water land away from the streams and said that that was a superior right on Hawaiian law than someone who lived along the streams. But they were following Western notions of law because the very same thing was happening on the mainland. That water was a commodity. If it was not used, it was wasted. And so the person who uses it had a superior right. So if I were living along the stream and I happened not to want to use it at the time and somebody came, dug a ditch and took it away, they had the right to do that. Now, under Hawaiian law, you only did it, under Hawaiian traditions, you only did it on the land traditionally that you watered for taro and other means. But the law radically changed over the next 20 or 30 years so that you could take the water, any basin in the Aotearoa, then you could take the water to another Aotearoa, then you could take the water anywhere, and you could waste it all and nobody could do anything about it. But in finally in 1973, the Hawaii Supreme Court, who strangely had the first, its first Chief Justice, the first Native Hawaiian, William Richardson, came to the conclusion that, all of that was not correct. Under the Great Mahele of 1850, when private land first became in effect, the water rights were never transferred with the land, and water was a public trust. Owned by a state for the benefit of all the people in the state. Now we fast forward to now, and that was in 1973. That's still, even though that's the law, under the old things, we're still having water being taken away, because unless someone asserts their right to use the water, someone who actually has no legal right to use the water, but uses it in a productive way, can still use it. But now we have first the Waiole ditch case on Oahu, and now we have two enormous cases on Maui. The first one, which I can't talk about because I was the hearing officer involves the four streams of Navajo, which are the streams that run through the middle of Kahului and Wailuku. And the others are the 27 streams that run from Hana back to Kahului. And all of these, for example, 27 streams have a ditch cut across the top part of it, right across all the streams. And any water, the only water that gets down below is any water that happens to get into the stream from below the ditches. If you're familiar with Maui, if you go from the nature center right outside of Yale Valley State Park and walk down to the stream bed, there is a metal culvert across the entire stream bed that when the water comes down, it goes all into that and gets taken away. So that is being changed now. And the reason for that is under the 78 Constitution and under the State Water Code of 87, what are now called appurtenant rights, which is the right on old Tarawa lands, they have superior rights to anybody else. And so we are now in a big battle between the sugar companies, the last one in slow demise, and Hawaiian slavering for their water rights. Now, the way you prove water rights in Hawaii under the old Hawaii system is that it's just very quirky. You come up with your land grant deed from the 1850s. You show, many of them have crude maps on it. And say I got a grant for 5 acres. And I had a house, I had a banana patch, I had some sweet potatoes, and I had 10 lori. But at the time I got my deed, only 8 were in production, the other 2 were resting. You get water only for those 8 lori. Just happened to be the way it is. And a pittance of water for your house and for your sweet potato and your bananas. But the wetland tower is the one that uses the most water. And the way you prove it is that since they said, well, it's not practical for you to tell me how much water you expect in 1850. So you come forward and say, I am going to grow a tower the traditional way. If you do that, then we can say, oh, you're going to need so much water. But taro is an interesting thing. Under the system of the old system, if you measure water going in and water coming out, the difference comes up depending where you are, between just about 0 in on the Lake Valley, which is very low, to maybe 40,000 gallons an acre. But most of that is leaking out. Okay. But you may have to run up to 1 million gallons a day of water through that to keep the taro patches cool, otherwise you could rot. So it's going to be a very difficult issue for figuring out, because most plants take, a household takes 1,500 gallons a day. Sugarcane, which is a thirsty plant, takes about 7,000, 6,000 to 7,000 gallons. A taro patch would require about 40,000 gallons, plus an average of maybe 300,000 gallons a year running through it. So, what is happening now is that I just came from a place where if you go and they start to clear the land, you find lori upon lori upon lori in the brush. And they all want to have them close back. If you go any of these, especially on Maui and other places like that. So there is going to be a big battle. But what that eventually does is that if you restore the streams and you restore enough taro lori, you're going to be able to practice more of the traditional dietary practices. I'm not saying that that alone is going to revive Hawaiian health and make them as lean as they were in the drawings that you see from the old days, when the people that came with Captain Cook drew pictures and showed you what they really looked like at that time. But I think that with an opportunity for engaging in those kinds of practices, being able to actually catch fish again in the stream, to grow taro to share with your Ohana family, will cause a greater effect in the amount of taro that you can eat or have available on your family for each of those taro patches. So that is where we are now, and interestingly enough, it's the legal issues and the reflection of the change in societal values in Hawaii and in the United States, because in the United States, the same thing is happening. If you read recent California law, the farmers are now worried because they're having to restore water back to the deltas and the streams. And it's a big battle again going on. But 73 was the linchpin for which that could have happened. That's what, 30-something years ago? So I think that it's not going to come in the next 10. It may come a little bit after that, it may continue to grow. But the law is actually finally on the side of trying to revive these traditions. And the tough part will be trying to implement how that will happen. I have my own ideas about the legal strategies that have been undertaken by, for example, the Native Legal Hawaiian Corporation, Native Hawaiian Legal Corporation. I think they're doing it too indirectly. I think there's a frontal assault way of doing it. But we can talk about that if anybody's interested. So, the theme of this convention is water and public health. And what I'm trying to convey to you is that the societal attitudes in the legal system has finally turned that it actually gives the Hawaiians the right to reassert their old practices.